Eli Rivera is the kind of human you want by your side when things are tough. Based in Keene, New Hampshire, Eli is the elected sheriff of Cheshire County. His service to his community has remained compassionate and thoughtful, applying lessons he learned within the Clay Hunt Fellows program of Cohort 5 has made him a better humanitarian. An easy smile and honest laugh are his calling card, whether it's on a Team Rubicon disaster site, the beaches of Puerto Rico, or in the mountains of New Hampshire. Eli has always led with his heart. Eli Rivera, how are you?
I'm doing good. How are you doing, Mike?
I'm good. I'm really good. Hey, so I'm really happy to have you here, and I appreciate you giving some time. And I just want to, you know, I want to hear a little bit about you.
About who Eli is, huh?
Exactly.
So I was born in New York. Raised in Puerto Rico after my father got a transfer to back to his hometown in Vega Alta as a postal worker. Went to most of middle school, high school, started some college in Puerto Rico before I joined the service and went on to the U.S. Coast Guard full-time, active duty. From there, after serving the Coast Guard for 5 years, I met my wife close to the end in Maine. Yeah, from Puerto Rico to Maine. Can you believe that? met my wife there and eventually ended up settling down in Keene, New Hampshire. And I've been here for almost 30 years. I have three wonderful children, beautiful kids. Dana, she lives in New York and she's a union plumber. She's the oldest. I have my son, Casey, who lives in San Francisco and works for Facebook as a mechanical data engineer, something like that. And I have my youngest son, Ryan, who lives in New York City as a financial advisor. I've been in law enforcement for over 30 years as well. Retired from a local police department as a lieutenant, and then became the elected sheriff, and I've been the sheriff for 8 years. So that's in a nutshell a little bit of my bio. Team Rubicon came into the picture around about 5 years ago when I attended a emergency management conference in New Hampshire, and they had a table set up, and I met Dana, Alan, Peter, Alicia, I think, was there, and a handful of other gray shirts. And we got to talking, and I went home and was very interested about what I learned about Team Rubicon. And that very same evening, I went online, looked it up, read about it, and signed up. And I've been very active ever since. So,
well, and what's interesting to me when, you know, you see a bunch of folks, and I know some of these characters because they are characters, you know, it's amazing to me how excited we are about our organization when we talk to other people. And I love it that it was a table, a booth, you know, and you got to chat with some folks, and there's something compelling about our passion for what we do. And you know, it's interesting to me that you're a sheriff in Keene, New Hampshire, and you're active in Team Rubicon. How do you feel those complement one another?
Well, they complement each other quite a bit because it's all around service to others. You know, as a sheriff, my responsibility to make sure that my community is safe, that we provide services with integrity, professionalism, and ethical to support the community that I live and work in. With TR, the mission is pretty similar. It's a service to others in their greatest moment of need or when tragic strikes where they reach out for that helping hand, and they kind of, the both of them kind of mirror each other because of the purpose of what they do, of how we do our jobs. It's that service to others, ensuring the safety, that our communities are safe, and in times of needs, we're there for when they reach out. So they pretty much, in my opinion, kind of match what I do as a gray shirt and as the sheriff.
You know, this theme of service is very strong for you. It's not just your law enforcement experience as a sheriff there in Keene, New Hampshire. You were in the Coast Guard, and I'd like to hear a little bit about that experience and then kind of how that, you know, wraps into what you're doing today.
I joined the Coast Guard in 84 and to 1989. When I was in high school and through my first year of college in Puerto Rico, I used to be a big surfer, and I used to spend a lot of time at the beach. And it was one of those things, you know, what am I going to do when it's, you know, when I get a little older? And happened to a Coast Guard helicopter and a Coast Guard patrol boat happened to be within, I don't know, a half a mile from where I was surfing. They were doing some drills, rescue drills, and they would drop the swimmer into the water, and then they pick him up, and they will hoist him from the Coast Guard boat. And I'm like, that's it. That's what I'm going to go. And I was just so amazed about the work they were doing and just watching them train from the distance. On my surfboard kind of got me thinking about that would be the service that I would like to do. So I looked them up, learned a little bit more, and I was within 6 months off to boot camp and join the Coast Guard. The Coast Guard was very rewarding. I did go from Puerto Rico, 98 degrees, to Portland, Maine, in December.
Oh my God! I've lived in Maine, and that's horrible change. Oh my gosh!
So I went to boot camp in October, completed boot camp by December. Was allowed to go home for a week before I had to report to my duty station. And it was like December, you know, right after Christmas, and it was pretty cold. And, you know, here I am in Puerto Rico, it was 80 plus degrees, you know, in my early 20s. And I shows up in Portland, Maine, this guy with a suntan, you know, I'm like, oh my God, this is so cold. Arrive on my ship, which Coast Guard ice-breaking tugboat that they use to break ice around the Penobscot River and all the coast of the Portland, Maine and Casco Bay. And that's what we were doing, breaking ice. And I'm thinking about, that's not what I saw that day, that helicopter and that boat practicing. This is where this come from. But it turned out to be very rewarding. I ended up becoming a bosun mate and was responsible for actually piloting that same 41-footer that I saw in the distance when I was surfing that day, and became a patrol coxswain for the patrol boat and the heavy weather rescue boat, which was a 44-footer designed for any type of weather, and it could flip and do a 180 and rewrite itself. That never happened to me while I was there, but it was capable of doing that. So I'm going out at any time, no matter what conditions we had, to rescue someone or save someone who was having a difficulty, again, reaching out for that time in need, was something that always kind of meant a lot to me. And in the Coast Guard, I was able to do that as well.
So you did this time in the Coast Guard, some time in the Army Reserve, and you've been doing this law enforcement thing, and you feel like Team Rubicon and what you do for work is very compatible. You know, you've had a very good experience in Team Rubicon. You've done a lot. You do a lot in your local community, specifically there in New England. But you also joined the Clay Hunt Fellows Program.
And I've been able to manage both.
And I feel like, what was that compelling reason? And what do you feel the outcome has been from that?
I applied for the fellowship back in 2017, and I've read about it, I have learned about it, and felt that there was a place for me that I needed to visit, and that the fellowship was going to help me get there. I put in my application, and a very good friend of mine, through Team Rubicon, wrote the letter of recommendation, which I did not see, and did not want to see.
And why is that? Why didn't you want to see it?
Because I felt it was her way, to being very honest about who I am and why she was recommending it. Mm-hmm. You know, she might leave some things out if I was to see it. So I felt that would be a truthful letter on her part about who I am. And, you know, it could have been a letter saying, I don't recommend him, which I would have been fine because I don't know what the contents of the letter were.
You still don't.
And I still don't. But I did get accepted.
Yeah.
So I get the call from Michael Davis saying, Eli, I just want to let you know that we are going to send you to, we're going to bring you on board to the, you've been approved to join the, to come on board. And I thought and I thought, and I asked him, why me? And his answer back, which is something that I think about a lot, is because of who you are. Mm. And at the same time, and that happened around March, a colleague of mine, a very close friend and local police chief, committed suicide like the week before. And I was in a tough spot about that. And being accepted into this fellowship came at the right time, knowing that I was in a pretty deep mental state of losing my friend 3 years ago. So in the conversations that I had with Michael about the fellowship, I did mention that to him, and I felt that this was an opportunity that I was being given to do a deep dive into who I am and how can I become a better person with the fellowship.
And I remember that first week. You know, it was tough. It was very emotionally raw, and it was weird. Once you're given permission to be vulnerable, it's amazing how quickly that whole house of cards that we built up around some of the things that we don't want to be vulnerable about comes down. And it was an interesting week. It was an amazing week, but it was also very challenging, just because if you're not used to being vulnerable in that way with really complete strangers, but it was a safe space. I remember that. And I do remember that week being hard on you, but you could see that weight being lifted off once you kind of acknowledge where that weight is.
Well, if you think back a little bit, I've been a cop for 20 plus years when I showed up at that orientation in LA, and you know, and for the longest time I was, you can't be vulnerable, you can't show your emotion, you gotta be tough, you gotta make sure you hide everything, don't let anyone know your weaknesses. And and when you hear that repetitively for years and years and years, you know, that as a cop you have to be, you know, you can't be weak, you can't be vulnerable, You have to, hide all that and not let anyone know or show who you are. Versus the message that I was being given from day one when I walked into that office. No, it's the opposite. You have to be vulnerable. You have to show your emotions. You're a stronger person by doing so. And I remember when Jake walked in, and you probably remember this, when Jake would walked in and he said to us, be prepared to show your vulnerabilities and don't be afraid of it, something like that. And I just looked at him and say, you want me to be vulnerable? That's scary. That I've been a cop for so long and that's not who I am. And over the time that I spent at the orientation and deep dive into who I was over the following months at home with my advisor and my swim buddies and stuff and just going over that U school book and reading some of the books that we were asked to read about vulnerability and the transformation that I can see as I went on and on, deep diving into who I was, about having going about this the wrong way all this time, and realized that my strength was my vulnerability, being able to learn from it and not be afraid to express my emotions and be vulnerable in front of people, versus the I can't be a Mr. Macho Man, I can't do that, has made me a better person in my and how the way I deal with people on the streets, the way I deal with my staff, the way I deal with my family. To this day, I still email Michael from time to time and thank him for the opportunity of being a Clay Hunt Fellow and allowing me to go to the fellowship and really become the person who I am now.
I think that's some really good insight. And I think that, I was fortunate enough to go through that journey with you, and I would echo a lot of the same things. And I've noticed a little bit of a theme with, a lot of the opportunities I've had to talk to other people, and that vulnerability becomes very, very important. It becomes important just because being honest with ourselves about our strengths and our weaknesses and the things that make us fearful is powerful. And it unloads a burden that I don't think we realize how troublesome that can be. I think it's very interesting having this conversation in this time that we're living in right now, where you said it yourself, for 20 years you were told, you have to be tough, you have to be hard, you can't show weakness, no vulnerability. And yet understanding what that looks like on the other side, do you understand those two differences and how powerful they are from an impact statement, as far as dealing with the public?
I strongly believe, and I was just thinking about this because of everything that's happening, is if you don't adapt a sense of love and belonging to your community, you cannot be successful in this job. You must love where you live, you must love the community you work for, and you must feel that sense of belonging to the community that you work for and the people that are asking you to represent you. And once you have that, you can serve them, you can protect them, you can ensure that they follow the laws or and the policies and the ordinances within the communities without having to be too authoritarian or powerful. No, you can either you have love for the community and a sense of belonging and you can do everything, or you can walk in and say, I'm the power, I'm the authoritarian, I'm gonna exercise that and not care for the community. That doesn't work. When you take one without the other, you're setting up yourself to failure. You're going to set up yourself to what we're seeing nowadays on television. Sometimes we forget that, yes, we've been hired or appointed to protect our communities, but that doesn't mean you can't love and belong to your community. And I guess wisdom has kicked in over the years that you have to have the two to be successful.
I think that was a real beautiful statement right there. And I feel like we all have our own reasons for being where we are, you know, there's a myriad of them and everyone's different. And I know that, you know, when I go out in the field with Team Rubicon or I go out and do things in my community where I live, I've noticed, especially over the last few years, since kind of understanding a little bit about myself, it's a lot easier to interact with people in your community that you may not agree exactly what they're doing right that moment. If you come at it from the place that I don't know that a lot of people in this world intend to do things that don't work within the norms of their community. And, you know, communities are different all over the United States. You know, we have different acceptability of behaviors. And I think that that's coming at it, or it's like, maybe this person doesn't know, maybe this person's having a rough day. You don't know what everybody's going through on a day in and day out basis. And I think, you know, the challenges that we live in now are not only do we have these challenges within our communities regarding race or social economic status, but we also have this pandemic that's going on that is complicating the hell out of everything else. And I think that, you know, being in the position that you're in, or just being in a service position in any capacity, is challenging right now.
It is.
You know, everybody's resource scared. Everybody is, in a lot of ways, are just fear in general.
Yeah. But one of the things that I think has helped me get to where I'm at is that I realized as part of the fellow, when I was going to the fellowship, that I needed to take care of myself first before I can take care of others. And you remember me when I walked in into that orientation in July, I was 275 pounds.
There's a lot of Eli boy. Left.
And as I went to the fellowship, I realized I need to take care of myself. And I've been able to, really dive into that and feel comfortable with who I am by losing weight, by starting to physically take care of myself, by exercising. I'm changing my diet. And that in itself was part of the realization from the Clay Hunt Fellowship and going through U School about going through that deep dive of who I am as a person. What have I done and where was I failing? And one of the failures that I highlighted was that I was not taking care of myself physically and I needed to do something about it. And I have, and I feel good about it. And once I felt good about myself and I was able to actually be even more committed to the mission of Team Rubicon and to the mission of servicing my community as a sheriff. You know, we can sign up for operations, go to somebody's home, muck out their basement, and walk out and not take a few minutes to sit down with that homeowner and hear the story and understand where they are, understand what they went through, and understand what are we doing to make life a little better for them. And we don't take those few minutes to understand that. You can muck out all you want. You can tear down walls all you want. You're not going to get the real purpose of being at that home as a gray shirt, because there's so much value in that. Same thing with me. If I went to some sort of tragic at the sheriff and I did not spend that extra time with those involved, you know, all I am is just a guy in uniform that came in here, did his business, and left. I'm feeling like I have not given those that are there asking for my help the attention that they need, and that's important to me. That not only do I do something to make their lives better, that I take the time to listen to their story, listen to what they have to say. And sometimes all it takes is a handshake with their acknowledgement, or a hug and tears, or sit down on the porch steps and have a conversation. But those little gestures mean so much to those involved and to me as a person.
I think it's that balance we're looking for as humans. I think that, you know, getting that balance in our life, you know, and I think it's why a lot of times people feel like they need to act out or they need to make a lot of noise because they're not being heard, as their fellow humans aren't listening. And I think that, you know, vulnerability is a big part of that. Owning your story. Everybody's got a story that's got some dark passages in it, some places that we aren't proud of, some moments where we did not act our best or behave in a way that represents ourselves and our communities really well. But that doesn't necessarily ruin the rest of the story. It's just a part of it. I think that, you know, in my mind, what I learned a lot from the Fellows program, and I know you did too, because we've talked about this, and to say you lost a little bit of weight is an understatement, by the way. I'm just going to go back to that really quickly. You are a lean, mean fighting machine these days, and you look great. It's great to see you doing some of the things you're doing. And you know, that took an extraordinary amount of work and self-determination to get to where you are right now. And you should be very proud of that. But I think that when I look at how important stories are to ourselves, because they teach us things, about ourselves. When you're, you know, when we get a chance to tell our stories with one another, it shows that vulnerability, that we make mistakes, that we learn from them, that we grow up, but we understand that we evolve. And vulnerability is a great tool in that. And what I love about this organization is when you're working shoulder to shoulder with somebody in a community that you may not have any attachment to, you may have traveled there, or it may be your community that you live in, you may know these people. But the act of serving somebody else opens up, it makes all that stuff easier, the ability to share on both sides of that, mm-hmm. both the person being taken care of and the person doing the work. That's the beauty of what we do as an organization. And that's why a lot of people still keep coming back. That's why you keep coming back. That's why I keep coming back, is there is something that we get in return. And it is part of that whole self-care routine. There's a reason why we can leave our homes, leave our families, leave our jobs, leave the comfort of our community to go somewhere else to do work in less than stellar environments because of any number of things. We're willing to sleep on a cot, which I'm not a big fan of sleeping on a cot. I'm just not. It's not, you know, everyone's like, well, what are your alternative? And I'm like, well, as much as I hate to say it, I'd almost rather sleep on the ground, but that isn't always a good option either in the places that we go to. So, you know, we eat some horrible food, but we also eat some amazing food. So I don't want to make it about that, but again, anytime you're out of your comfort zone and you can't have the things that you're normally associating with your own good well-being in life, it's hard. But we do it because there is something in return that does care for us.
And you never know when you're going to be serving at. You never know when the call to an operation might bring you to your own backyard. As you remember, when during our fellowship, it was one of the toughest times for Team Rubicon. We had Maria, and we had a couple of events that kind of took us away from our fellowship for a little bit to support the mission of Team Rubicon. You know, the hurricane went over Puerto Rico. We were disconnected for many weeks, and as you remember, I was so hopeless because I couldn't hear from my parents, and at the same time, I knew that Team Rubicon was trying to deploy to Puerto Rico, and when we finally connected with my parents, it was such a relief, and when to know that they were doing okay, that yes, we have some inconveniences where everybody's okay and we will be able to manage. And follow that with Team Rubicon spending a number of weeks there and actually working in my own hometown in Vega Alta, doing some roof repairs and helping folks. Never in my life would ever thought that was going to happen. So you never know where Team Rubicon is going to be. And like I said, it might be right in your backyard, supporting a family. And so when the call comes for Team Rubicon, we will go wherever it takes and help whoever needs us and make it happen. And knowing that I had some gray shirts that I knew that on a phone call could go check on my parents because I wasn't able to get in touch with them, was a good feeling, was a good peace of mind that
thanks for
helped
listening.
Me stay at peace at over here in the States while I do what I had to do to make sure they were okay. So, I mean, as you know, you spend some time down there and the conditions were not good, and knowing that we were able to help, like I said, it just a good feeling because it can be your neighborhood next week, and we would do anything that we can to be there and try to help. So that's one of the reasons I love this organization, and I've been connected to it because they don't care who you are, where you come from, or where you are in life journey. If they can extend a hand, they will.
I have nothing to add to that. That is, and it's beautiful and it's true. What I think is so amazing about where we are today, you know, from 10 years ago, is that earnestness of helping is still there. It doesn't go away. And it gets refreshed and renewed as new members come on board and as things change, as capabilities change, as our view of how we can help as humanitarians doesn't change. We just want to help. And I think you've laid out a really good roadmap for folks to be able to follow as far as, you know, you got to be able to take care of yourself. You got to be able to understand your own weaknesses. You got to be comfortable with your stories, all the warts and all, and go out there with an open heart and you're going to do just fine. I think that also really sums up who you are as a human.
and that's important. And that's important, you know. We all have our reasons why we joined our organizations. We all have our reasons what track we pick within the organizations. I have to say, the Clay Hunt Fellows track, not only did it help me become an ambassador for the organization, it's helped me in with the job that I do today. And we know what's going on right now nationwide with all the protests and that we've seen on TV and how different organizations have had to deal with the protests, how they find a way to make sure the community is safe. And there's been different levels of interaction with the different locations these protests happened. We've had a couple in Keene where I live, and this past week, and one of the bigger ones that we were invited to attend, the chief of police, myself, and another officer felt that it was just going to be the three of us going in, everybody, no one else, and we're just going to mingle with the group, about 800 people, give or take. And as we mingled with the group, you know, trying to see, we felt, well, I need to do something more. I told myself, I need to do something more. And this little girl came up to me and said, "Hey, you want to make a sign?" So I thought about it, and I'm thinking to myself, what is my message? And I said, no, it's not what is my message. What is their message? I got to make sure that I hear the message, and came up with the line, "We hear you," because it was three of us. So I run on a poster board, you know, "We hear you." And the chief of police and the other officer followed shortly after. And we walk around the crowd with that message to make sure that they knew that I was listening to what they were. Wanted us to say, wanted us to hear. And my commitment was to go back and make sure that their voices were heard and not forgotten. During an interview, I said, that sign that we hear was my riot shield for that day. And that's what helped me hear what the message was, give the hope to those there that we were listening. And now I need to go back and make sure that those voices are not forgotten. So that was my commitment to the crowd. And since I walked away that day with that sign, that's all I've been working on, making sure that the voices are not forgotten.
And what was the response that day
Towards.
to the, yeah, towards you and to the other
Well,
officers that were with you?
people will do. We just kind of mingle in the crowd, and when people notice, we'll look up and then realize we were holding a sign right in the middle of the protest with them and waving and with our signs up in the air or walking around through the crowd. They were like, we'll take double takes and make sure, is that what I'm reading? Is that what I'm seeing? They're not here to police us, but instead they're here to participate and join us. It brought tears to some folks. People wanted to make sure that they took pictures with us, even though we didn't do it for photo op. But they want to make sure that they share this with other folks that were there and those that missed it. One of the event organizers was, you know, this is the first time that we have been met. That we've been met by three officers holding signs saying that they're hearing us, which gives us hope that everyone else is. Versus looking at the corners, outside corners, police looking, watching in at us to make sure we stay in line, versus you being in here with us, telling us you're hearing what we have to say. And that was a powerful message to them. as well as me letting them know that I was listening to what they were expressing and that I needed to go back and make sure that I don't forget that.
This has been something of, you know, this moment and, you know, and seeing the photograph of that and, you know, kind of talking with you briefly about it has been a powerful moment for me personally. And it's something that I think that I've learned is that right now I need to listen. I need to listen very, very, very hard. And I hope that as this continues to work its way through our day-to-day life, that the things that we're listening to and the lessons we're learning right now take hold in a tangible way that make a positive impact. And beyond that, I'm very proud of you personally, as my friend, seeing you take a very bold act of bravery to listen is sometimes a very challenging thing. And I hope that the application of what you've heard is, compels you to continue.
And it's not about, the chief and I wanted to make it sure to the people there, it's not about, we don't want to make this about us, about the chief and the sheriff here. We want to make this about you and your message that you want to give us. And this is your opportunity to do that. And we want to make sure we bring it back. So while we felt sort of uncomfortable where people were asking to take pictures because we didn't want to take away from the event, where people focus, we want to make sure, and we felt that we did, that I think because of our method of participating, helped the rally stay peaceful. Everyone within 3 hours, 3.5 hours, 4 hours, the rally was over, with no incidents, no arrests, no misbehavior, nothing that would it tarnish the purpose of their message. And their message was heard loud and clear.
Have you got any feedback from anybody in your community about that whole situation? Key New Hampshire is not a large municipality, but it's near a lot of, you know, larger communities on the East Coast. And did you feel like you represented your community? When did you get any feedback in with that regard?
We've received a lot of positive feedback and thank yous from members of the community, both the chief and I, about the way we handled our appearance at the protest. It just gave the community an affirmation that, like I mentioned earlier, that we were there to listen, that we were humbling ourselves, we were humbling ourselves to understand what their struggles have been over the years, why they were angry, and what can we do as the leaders of the police department, the sheriff's office, in that community, to make them feel understood, not fear our officers, our deputies, and that we cared. So,
well, I feel like that message came out that day, you know, loud and clear. And it was a, I think it was a poignant, thing. And it's just from my perspective on, you know, the opposite side of the country, looking in and reading about what was happening out there. I think that, you know, that it, to dovetail that back into the organization as well, I think listening to what we're doing and our, how we're responding and what we're saying or not saying right now is very important as well. You know, we don't want to, I don't know how to even put this, but it, I think being humanitarians really strikes at the heart of what we try and do. And if you're a humanitarian, all the stuff that identifies us, all the things that label us, starts to go away if you come at it through the optic of being a humanitarian. And I think that that humanitarian spirit can definitely be a great navigation tool as we move through this time of understanding and growth and quite honestly, some revolution. It takes some revolutionary thinking right now, I think, to change perceptions, change behavior, change a lot of the fundamentals of what we think of ourselves and how our community thinks of ourselves. And I think that humanitarian optic really should and can help us. If you're just a big fan of humans, it doesn't matter what all the labels are. You're just a big fan of it, of your fellow humans. And I think that that's...
I went in there with a different perspective. The outcome was better. I felt good about of myself. People felt good about their interactions and us being there with them. That, and that's where I say that the fellowship has helped me become who I am now.
Well, and I think that. I think we're all given lessons. We're all given opportunities to take stock of who we are and what we are and how we are. And understanding why we make decisions and understanding why we feel the way we do about things is a very important part of that process as well. And I think that the Fellows program, it definitely puts an optic on parts of your life that you don't necessarily want to go to or you don't deal with on a day-to-day basis. And I also believe that it is a call to make improvements to ourselves that last and that affect others. It can't just be about, you know, it provides tools for us to take care of ourselves, but it also in that process allows us to take care of others. You start your ability to grasp larger groups of people start happening. And I appreciate the Fellows program for that.
My youth school book is like falling to pieces because I continuously go back to it. And I have like a keep a red pen stuck on the little spiral thing there where I will add, cross out, circle something that I've done, something that I've changed, something that I, needs more work, something that I could accomplish. But I'm gonna tell you, that thing is like falling apart because I continuously use it as a reference to remind me of that journey that I took 3 years ago when I walked into LA for my orientation, and to me it hasn't ended yet.
Well, it's that whole reason why we do a lot of the things we do, you know, just because we get in a comfortable space or just because we're, you know, born, raised in a certain area or whatever, we still need to evolve. And I think that that's what the Fellows program does. But I also believe that that's what Team Rubicon asks us to do every day is to evolve and to, you know, by making that evolutionary step day by day. It allows us to go out there and be good humanitarians, serve our communities, and take care of the folks who need a little help. And I think that that's a fitting way to close this one out. Thank you for being you and for being daring and taking some risks. We need a lot more of that these days. Leading with love is not an easy thing to do. Love challenges our ability to navigate. Love makes us take the rougher road, climb the higher peak, and head out into the unknown. Love is not something we talk about enough when it comes to leading, following, team dynamics, and humanitarian action. Let's keep loving our conversations. It will take us to great places and build amazing gray shirts. Thanks for listening.